Hey, you can talk to me. If your phone call does come through, feel free to take it. It's not the end of the world.
Okay, I'm going to turn that off.
You can pause and stop. Especially if it's about your pumps, then
yeah,
I get it.
Okay.
So I guess kind of let's go back to the beginning from here. Yeah, you were born and raised around here? Are you from Redcliffe originally?
Yes, I'm born and raised here in Redcliffe. Both my parents are tribal members, and yeah, I've been here ever since.
So growing up, I said we met your uncle. You were set loose in the woods. Is that kind of the stories?
Oh yeah, for sure. Was, taught how to run a chainsaw from my uncle, and you know, we did a lot of hunting, and we also did a lot of spearing with my cousin. He taught me a lot too in the spearing.
So, was there just a natural connection, or was it like being with other kids that made it more enjoyable, or, you know, how does that all come together?
I guess it was just the way we did stuff around here. It was just, I thought it was normal to be able to go spearing or go hunting, and we also were in the woods running our sugar bush in the spring, and we did a lot of our treaty rights we were exercising.
And was that obviously it was a conscious choice, but was it very intentional? Like asserting the rights is an important step to maintaining those rights.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't know it at the time. You know, I thought, like I said, I thought it was normal. I thought everyone was doing it. And then, you know, as I got older, I realized that, you know, those rights are very important for our tribe and, you know, tribal members and in general. I do too.
Oh, yes. Okay. We won't make you wait the whole time.
Sorry. Wow, look at this.
Yeah, fancy setup.
All right, carry on.
Does Andre have all this stuff?
You have some.
Okay.
So.
That's a good enough answer.
See ya.
See ya.
When did you first start working in the Natural Resources Department then?
So I've been with the tribe in Natural Resources for 11 years now. But before that, I worked for the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point Aquaculture Facility for 5 years, and that's really what got me into raising fish.
Okay, so you were at NADF?
Yeah, I was at NADF for 5 years.
Okay.
Yep.
So was it a natural progression to cross the street?
Yeah, for sure. It was, I pretty much got taught everything I needed to know to come here and be able to raise fish, indoors and outdoors.
Was that something that the tribe had been doing here, or was it important for you to come with that knowledge and bring that with you?
Yeah, it wasn't really something the tribe was doing. It was just, it just kind of happened that way. Like, I actually just had come home from college and was looking for a job, and I knew that I was into fish, and it worked out good.
So what was the program, what did it look like, I guess, and how much has it changed since you came with that knowledge of how to run it?
Yeah, so I mean, the program was running pretty good. It just, I did bring more knowledge, and we were able to improve on raising the fish, like having better quality fish. We improved our ponds, and we're still improving every year by getting better, you know, more knowledge with how to raise fish, and it's getting a lot better.
So explain to me the philosophy that comes behind the whole hatchery process that you have here. What goes into the judgments that you make about where to get eggs from, when to put back, how much to stock, you know, all that.
Yeah, so with walleye, we get eggs from the lakes that our tribe spears. So we're not only, you know, taking walleye from the lake, but we're also putting the walleye back in the lake, you know. Most people don't know that we you know, stock walleye back in the lake. We're not just taking walleye.
I mean, how do you choose which lakes? Like, last year, the Upper St. Croix, this year,
Middle Clare Lake.
Middle Clare, and
yeah.
I mean, Namakagan, that's a different relationship, but
yeah.
Is it just kind of like you have a running pattern?
Yeah, pretty much. So, really, it's all about the density of the lake. You know, right now, when I used to spear Middle Clare, there was 4 adult walleye per acre in the lake, and right now there's only 1 adult per acre. So we're trying to, you know, increase the production. I mean, trying to put more fish in. So,
mm-hmm. Do most of the tribal members know about that process that you guys do? So obviously a lot of the public's unaware, but does your own community even aware of that part of that?
Yeah, the community's aware for sure. I mean, now with social media, it's the past few years, it's really been getting out there. Like, social media is making it well known that we're, you know, stocking fish, and we're getting some really good feedback.
So we were obviously with you last year when we went to St. Croix. I don't know if you remember offhand, but roughly what were some of the numbers you got out of those ponds? Because we were there for the first day of the ponds, I believe.
Yeah, so last year we stocked 9,000, just a little over 9,000 extended growth walleye. So they were 7 to 9 inches. And that's, in that lake, that's a really good number.
And those are healthy looking fish.
Yeah. 7 to 9 inches. I mean, so just growing them from spring to fall, and that's it.
And I mean, what does that mean for you to be a part of that process?
Yeah, it makes me feel really good, you know, and with the, with talking with the Lake Association, they're super happy with it, and it makes me feel, you know, pretty proud and happy to do it.
And it's kind of, I don't know how far back your history is. I mean, your uncle was talking about, you know, the early days of asserting treaty rights and some of the conflict that existed there and some of the, you know, the stereotypes that still came out of that some people still hold. How important is it to try and break through to people it's a different era, like you guys are putting more fish in than are actually coming out?
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, like I said, most people don't know that we put fish back in. And, you know, it is getting better, but it's still, you know, still needs more to get out there so people know.
Mm-hmm. One of the other factors is the mercury safety level maps. I mean, I was overhearing at the youth night, there was talking about, like, some people were still putting in claims on lakes that other people are saying, I would never eat a fish out of that lake.
Yeah, mercury is always a thing to worry about. I mean, that's why they have the parameters out there for people to, you know, not eat too much or try to catch a certain size, certain limit, and leave the big ones alone so hopefully they can spawn and keep things going.
Do you guys actively avoid stocking or interacting with a lake that has mercury? I mean, would it ever make sense to put fish into that lake?
Yeah, so we don't actually stock any lake that has a high mercury in it. So all the ones we do, that's not a factor. We're not worried about it.
Okay. Does that reduce the number of lakes that you're interacting with?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's tough. I mean, it makes it a little tougher to be able to, you know, try to keep everyone happy. But, I mean, there's also not that many lakes, so whatever lake our tribe is spearing is what we're trying to restock.
And how does that overlap work? Because we saw that Bad River was there on Friday night, and obviously the Laputa Ray is very close by.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you guys kind of work with each other to talk about who's going to go where, who stocks where, how that works?
Yeah, we definitely talk with the other tribes, and then we also talk with the state, because the state does stock certain lakes, and whatever lake the state's not stocking is what usually ones will stock. So they'll do different years.
And so tell me a little bit about how the Namekagon project came to be about, because that's a unique relationship, right?
Yeah. So I guess it came about when Mike came to me and said that they want more walleye in their lake, and we were the ones that since we're a tribe, we can actually, collect our eggs without having a bunch of permits, and then we can also stock the fish back in the lake without having, a bunch of permits.
So is that an unusual relationship? Because, I mean, it's not just a lake association of the tribe. Like, you have NADF, you have the DNR.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if it's an unusual relationship. I guess they really were the only ones that reached out saying that, can you help, with our population of walleye?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, are you more inclined to want to work with them if they're actually reaching out?
Yeah, I mean, so we always factor in, what lake we're spearing. And in Namekagon, we do spear a lot, so that was a big factor. And, I mean, and it also always comes down to funding. If we don't have funding to feed our walleye minnows, then we can't raise them. So we need funding to be able to raise walleye.
And does the Lake Association help with that, or is it?
Yeah, they definitely do. So this year we're doing Middle Eau Claire, and they donated some money to help with feeding our walleye.
Okay. Yeah, because you mentioned it's not cheap. Too.
No. Yeah.
Those minnows are getting trucked in from out of state.
Yeah, out of state for sure.
And when you look at the bill like that, is there federal money and then tribal money and then donated money? Does the DNR kick in, or where does all the different pots of money?
Yeah, so usually we get funding from the BIA, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and then we don't get any money from the state to do it, and then it's just the lake associations and BIA.
Okay, and so all of those factor in what you're able to do.
Yep, and then Glyphwick is also a big partner, and hopefully they can get some funding for us too.
Mm-hmm. And they've been doing surveys there, right?
Yep.
Glyphwick. What have you learned from any of the surveys? They did a Young of Year, and I think they did a spring survey this year. Do you know anything from what they've gotten?
We don't know yet. So the only thing we know is by mouth of word, they've told us that they've seen them, but they haven't analyzed the data yet.
Okay.
So.
And anecdotally, what would you expect to see? I mean, do you think that this has been a positive relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not only hoping that it's working. I mean, we're putting in a lot of work for it. So I'm hoping, and I think that it's working. Like this last study that Glyphwick did is that we made sure that they looked for fin clips on our walleye. So we'll know more within a year.
Okay. And then the left and right fin clip too is
yep.
That's interesting.
Yep. So different fin clips for the indoor raised fish.
Is that, I mean, how important is that distinction long term? I mean, could that really change how hatcheries work?
Yes, for sure. It's a lot easier to raise fish indoors with, you can control the everything pretty much. And then outdoors, it's, it's Mother Nature. She's in charge, and we just have to do what she says.
I mean, how many times have you just walked by the ponds and been like, well, we don't know.
Yeah, for sure. And then, it's the ducks were a major factor. And then you get muskrats can mess up your ponds. And then you have otters that if otter gets in there, they can eat a lot of fish.
Mm-hmm. So when you get the, we were there when you guys were taking the first pond out and you had all the volunteers come up. I mean, how important is that, not only for the labor, but just to have those people come and see, like, this is what we're working towards, or this is what some of our money is going towards, or this is what's going into our lake?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important to, you know, get the lake associations to help, and then they actually get to see what we are doing and know that it's not just easy just to raise fish. And then everyone thinks it's just easy. You put fish in water and they grow and you don't have to feed them. And then you can just take the fish out and put them in the lake. But yeah, it's a long process.
So for you, you've been doing this a long time. Like, how much of your mental energy is devoted to thinking about fish in a pond at any given time?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it all the time when all the fish are in there. It's, you know, it's, like I said, it's outdoors, so it's anything can go wrong.
I mean, are you, like, you look out in the weather and you go, oh, it's sunny today. I mean,
yeah, oh yeah. So that's one thing we do with our ponds is once there's fish in there, we'll check them every single day. You know, we're checking to make sure the oxygen's good. We're checking for making sure that the water is turbid. It's darker. I mean, you don't want it too turbid either. You want it to... So walleye are very cannibalistic. They'll eat each other a lot. So if you keep the water darker, that definitely keeps down the cannibalism. So we're there checking every day.
So walleye themselves should be on the list of things that can ruin the walleye population.
Yes, for sure.
Well, and that happens in the regular lake as well.
Yep, for sure. I mean, walleye are very aggressive fish, and they'll eat their brothers and sisters. They don't care. They're hungry.
Mm-hmm. So I guess take me back to when you were younger. How aware were you of what the walleye populations were at that time and some of the shifts that were occurring? As I guess a lot of lakes went from the late 90s into the early 2000s, there were some severe declines just due to a lot of different factors out there.
Yeah, so I guess when I was younger, when I was spearing a lot, it was... So every time you go spearing, you get a permit, and it has a certain amount of fish on it. Like, you know, you get a permit, and it says you get to spear 25 fish. And then as the years kept going on, it was, you know, go down and say 20 fish this time. Then all of a sudden, it was 15 fish. And that was when I realized that, you know, something was going wrong. Like, where are these fish going? Why is there less? And as I got older, I realized that, you know, there's a lot of factors. You know, it's not only the tribes taking fish, it's also the sports fishermen. They'll take a lot of fish. And the tribes, you know, they're regulated. Like I said, you get a permit, and there's wardens at the landing to make sure that you're taking your limit and not overdoing it.
I mean, can you imagine how much the hook and line fishermen would howl if every time their boat came in, they had to, like, open up the thing?
Yeah, they for sure would be. I think it should be the law to report how much fish you're catching. And, you know, there's a limit for a reason.
Mm-hmm. An honor system.
Yeah, honor system is very hard to...
I mean, that's kind of... It's a sad irony of the whole... stereotypes of the tribes taking all the fish when, like, you guys are under the strict limits that are actually watched.
Yep.
And they're not. And there's tons of documented evidence of fishermen just going back to the same lake day after day after day and filling a freezer.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, so we, working with the lake associations, a lot of the people actually live right on the lake. You know, they have, you know, they can see right out their front windows that there's a lot of sports fishermen out there catching a lot of fish, and you do see them, you know, bringing them back to shore and then going back out and catching more fish. So it's definitely not regulated as hard and as strict as what tribal fishermen spear.
And that's certainly not what the public might think if you asked the average person, like, who has tougher regulations on them.
Yes, for sure.
So... when you go through and you work with lake associations and you're changing minds one at a time, hopefully,
mm-hmm.
I mean, do you feel like that's changed Do you think that the perceptions have shifted over time?
Yes, for sure. So in my almost 11 years here, it's, like I said, the social media has gotten a lot better. I mean, there's always your haters on the social media saying that we're taking all the fish, but I think we are getting the word out a lot better that, you know, we are putting fish back in the lake.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about the youth spearfishing. I know you weren't able to be there, but have you done it before with your boys?
Yeah, yep, we've done it before. So every year the Red Cliff and Bad River Band put on a youth spearing night, and it's really nice because a lot of kids don't get the opportunity to go spearing. So it's really nice that the Boys and Girls Club of Red Cliff will take, you know, probably 25 kids to just that one night, and that'll be probably their only chance to be able to do it. And it's been great that we've been getting kids involved, and they are taking a liking to it. So it's nice to keep it going, really.
I mean, you know as well as anyone what it's like to be a parent and have kids' attention everywhere.
Yeah.
So what is that battle like to have kids like recognize, hey, this is not just a pastime, this is your culture, this is your history.
Yeah.
It's different than just something to do on a Sunday or a weekend.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's great because most kids don't know that they can actually get a tribal ID, you know, because without a tribal ID, you can't, you know, get your permit. And having that tribal ID feels like gives them some power, you know. They get to get their permit, and then they get to go spear some fish.
And just, I mean, at the end of the night, we saw a lot of kids, and they'd fillet them, and they'd have their bag walking around, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's got to be, because that's a big part of it, too. It's like, having the fillets, either to give to someone else or to use yourself.
Yeah, I mean, being able to feed your family with what you harvest is really big.
And that's something that, you know, can carry over into a connection that's here.
Yep, we're hoping so. We always say it's for the next 7 generations is what we're trying to work for.
And is that an older saying? Or?
Yeah, as far as I know, I just heard it a lot.
that's a long time.
Yeah, yep.
But that's the length of history that you guys are working with.
Yep.
Which is different from...
yeah.
You know, a lot of the rest of the state, you know, 7 generations, they're not on this continent.
Yeah, right.
They can't go back that far. but that's a reality for people up here.
Yep. We're definitely you know, fighting for our treaty rights to make sure that we get to exercise them and use them.
What is the competition like in terms of kids' interests of, like, leaving and just going to other parts of the states for opportunities versus having something that might be able to draw them back one day to understand, like, they've got a connection here no matter what?
Yeah, I mean, that is the connection you have. I mean, your home, you have, you have your rights on your reservation, and you have your treaty rights to be able to harvest and, you know, harvest fish, animals, anything really.
So talk to me a little bit about, like, walleye itself. What sets that species apart? I mean, why is it so culturally important?
Yeah, so, I mean, culturally important, it's just what I've known, you know. It's just always been the walleye. It's always been, you know, in my family and in my house. You know, it's food, fish for food, and it's... I guess it's just what I've known. I guess it's just walleye's always been, like, our go-to fish. I mean, they taste the best, I think, and I think they look the coolest, and it's always been part of my life.
It's probably more difficult to explain something that's that innate. It's almost like, tell me why ear is important.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, it's also, it's my job. It's been, you know, it helps pay the bills, you know, feed my kids, and it's just what we've done for years.
I mean, is there ever a day when you're looking at the fish, you're like, oh, I'm so sick of looking at walleye?
I guess I wouldn't say I get sick of them. I mean, some days you have your problems with that it gets, you know, hard to keep going, but it's, you know, I like to look at them as we are their parents, you know, raising these fish and hopefully giving them the best path to survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, that is a big part of, I mean, some of the reason why they're harder to find is natural recruitment is down. So, like, you are contributing to the part of making sure that there's still fish in the water.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, that's got to be an interesting relationship to build.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you do, I do feel like I grow connected to the fish and, you know, feel like a proud parent sending them off once I get them in the lake and they swim away.
Yeah. Well, especially you get to the end of the season and they come out and they look gorgeous. I mean, these are beautiful looking fish.
Yeah.
So I'm sure, you know, if they came out runty or, you know, something, you'd be like, okay, what went wrong? Said they look that good. There's got to be that. Like, we did a good job.
Yes, for sure. It's very proud moments putting them in the lake.
So for you and for your boys, I mean, if you're out spearing and you get one that's got the fin clip, I mean, is that a different connection?
Not really. I mean, it's nice to see. I mean, without spearing that fish, we wouldn't know that it was a hatchery raised fish. I mean, mm-hmm. if we don't have assessments on the lakes, there's no other way of knowing. And if people don't report back to us that there was a fin clip fish, and we wouldn't know. So it's nice to see.
Mm-hmm. And in the spring, you know, like, it's a busy season when you're out. I mean, we've been with you setting fike nets, collecting from fike nets, and night shocking. And I mean, are those long, draggy days, or is that the beginning of this whole process?
Yeah. So every year is different. We we always call it ice out. Wait for the ice to get off the lake, and every year it's the walleye aren't always spawning right away when the ice is gone, and we've had years where the walleye have actually spawned under the ice, so we weren't able to collect eggs. But I mean, it's when you're in the moment, it's it feels like you're doing a lot, but then you look back and it's only a month at the most, and you're like, I guess it wasn't too bad. You definitely do get groggy from working, you know, mornings, lifting your fike nets, and then working that same night, shocking and trying to collect eggs. It's tough work, but it's rewarding.
And then, I mean, what's that like for you when you've got a jar full of them, and then all of a sudden they start to hatch?
Oh, it's nice. It's real nice. Walleye eggs are so small, but it's crazy that you can get something the size of your eyelash to grow to 9 inches from just spring to fall.
And that's, you know, and it goes back and it starts the cycle over
again. Yep.
That's the whole point of it. So when we were at the spearing event, I think it was 2 fish per permit for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just enough to kind of whet their appetite?
Yeah, for sure. We definitely try to set a limit. We want everyone to at least get one fish, every kid to get at least one fish, but, you know, it's, some kids are better at it, and I just want to make sure to give each one of them opportunity to spear fish.
So when we were there, we saw the fish dance that we...
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's a whole celebration, like a whole festival surrounding it that...
Yep.
That it just... It wasn't. It's not just we go here, we get in a boat, we go see if we can spear some fish.
Right. Yep. So we definitely do the fish dance. It's all the males try to, you know, it's showing appreciation and trying to give thanks that, you know, that this water and this lake is giving us fish, and we want to make sure that it's known that we're just not there to take fish. We're, you know, following our tradition and trying to keep it right.
Mm-hmm. But making everything feel, I mean, there's a holistic process to all of that. It's got to, I mean, that is part of the inspiration for the kids. It's not just we go in a boat. It's like the whole thing is a celebration.
Yes, definitely is. I mean, we always, you know, we always want to offer something if we're taking something, you know.
And we did see the one kid who's speared a carp.
Yeah, there is suckers out there. I mean, you also have your pike fish, and then you'll have perch, and then the northern pike, and then you have muskies out there too. Those are always fun to spear. But
so are there separate seasons on those? Or you can spear
So muskies usually only has, they usually only get like one on your permit because they're so big and so sought after. Like they're fun.
Mm-hmm. They gotta be a little harder to pull in the boat.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And you talked about how walleye is an important food in your household. I mean, assuming, I mean, how regular do you eat it? I mean, are you following the guidelines, or guidelines aren't as for pregnant women and kids?
Yeah, definitely. So growing up, it was, I mean, you would have a fish fry every other week. You know, it's always good for a family get together to have a big walleye fish fry. And I definitely didn't follow the guidelines myself as a young man. I was definitely indulging on a lot of walleye. Fried walleye was just like candy.
And do your boys take after you in that?
Oh yeah, yeah. They definitely like fish.
That's got to be fun to see that come through in them. Like that's multiple. I mean, that's three of the seven generations, right? Right there, right between your uncle and down to you and your boys and
yep.
You know, now you've got another boy coming back closer to home.
Yep. Yeah, hopefully he takes it on too.
Is that difficult for you when, like, because I'm sure there's other dads that are setting up for spearing around the same time when you're working your 20-hour days.
Yeah, it's definitely become a lot more difficult now that I have this job, because it's one of our busiest times is collecting walleye eggs, and that's right when spearing happens. So it's makes it a little tough. And they only spawn for so long, and it's hard to get out there when you're trying to collect eggs.
So part of what our documentary is looking at is like the historical and cultural connections that the state has to walleye. And, you know, obviously in different areas of the state, you know, there's an economic connection, or there's, you know, the resorts or guides.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a similarity between the connection between the bands up here and walleye that's different, or is it just everyone can kind of universally, you know, have a connection to that fish?
Yeah, I mean, so we don't diversify anybody. You know, we want it to be for everyone. You know, we know that it's not just for us. You know, we want everyone to be able to get a part of it.
Is you can understand like that connection runs for everyone. I mean, it's an easy fish to love.
Yeah, yep. I know a lot of people have their, you know, their summer, spring, summer homes on the lakes, and they've spent money to have land there, have a dock there, and be able to catch these fish too. It's, you know, it's for them too.
And you know, obviously there's a lot of money that goes into keeping this species alive and thriving in some areas and barely hanging on in others, not only in terms of, you know, raising the fish and the stocking, but also the research that is being done to find out about habitat and when's the best time for this or that, or the indoor-outdoor raising. I mean, I'm assuming that you think that all that money is worth it, that all that time is justified for it?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. Like, I mean, you don't just get funding to have fun and go out there and make sure there's fish. I mean, you're out there actually, you know, making sure there is fish and making sure there's fish habitat and, you know, trying to regulate and everything, keep the population up. And
so what what would be the outcome if that wasn't possible, either through lack of funding or more environmental changes? And because there are some places where, you know, walleye's going away out of those lakes or those areas, and, you know, it's harder to justify trying to keep them alive. And, you know, for some fishermen, well, they'll move on to a crappie or to a bass or something different. But what would be the loss if walleye were that much more difficult or harder to find?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest loss would be food for feeding your family. I mean, if it wasn't, you know, regulated, like, there would be, it would be overfished, overspeared, and you would just run out of fish, really. There's nothing you can do if it's not regulated.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else that you want to add along the lines of what we've been talking about? Anything I might have missed?
No, I think I got it pretty well covered. I think I said the same thing a lot, making sure that we know that, or people know that we aren't just taking fish, we're putting fish back in. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my, one of my biggest things I want people to know is, you know, we're putting fish back.
Yeah, and, well, we've got video of that. Yeah. Plenty of evidence.
Yeah.
Can I get you to say and spell your name and your title, just so I have it correct?
Yeah. Okay, my name is Lance, L-A-N-C-E, Brissette, B-R-E-S-E-T-T-E, and I'm the hatchery specialist at Red Cliff Tribal Fish Hatchery.
Perfect.
Could I just get, like, 20 seconds of room tone?
Yep. So we're just going to, we'll be quiet, and he's going to record the sounds of the room.
Awesome, thanks.